Hey everybody, welcome to episode 19. We are going to talk about another Miyazaki film because that is what we have been talking about for the last few episodes. But before we get there, something hilarious happened this weekend that Justin and I were talking about, and I wanted you to share in the joy and fun we were having discussing it. If you didn't watch Saturday Night Live this weekend, I don't blame you. I don't really love Saturday Night Live and typically don't watch it every weekend. But every once in a while, the media picks up on something happening that will alert me. Maybe I should watch this sketch. Sometimes for good, sometimes for bad. But either way, I watch the sketch. John Mulaney, great comic, star of Big Mouth on Netflix, he was the host of the episode. He was a writer on the show before his career took off. And he had come back for the first time as a host and was able to produce a sketch that he had written in 2010, 8 years before now. And he had written this sketch, and he brought it back to the table and had them do it with him in it. It was titled Lobster Number One, I guess is what we would call it, or Diner Lobster.
Yeah.
And we started talking about the timing of this. And Justin, why don't you tell everybody what you were telling me?
Okay, well, first of all,
should we discuss the sketch itself?
We probably should discuss the sketch itself. The thing that I came away from the most from this sketch before we talk about it at all was Keenan is still on SNL, and I had not realized that. And that's like 10 years in the running. Is he like the longest SNL running cast member?
Bro, he might be at this point. He might actually be. And I'm okay with it because I've noticed the sketches that catch my attention every couple of months.
Always Keenan.
Always have him in it. And most of the time prominent.
Yeah, no, he's great. Pete's talking about this sketch that came out. We're dating this a little bit, but it's this lobster sketch. Essentially, John Mulaney had the idea of making something so ridiculous. And I can only imagine, I want to know what the seed for this idea was, but
I think Les Mis, the film version, had just come out.
Yeah, but I also I really want to know what line did he start with? Was it the line when, I think it was the line when the girl comes out and she says,
the sister or the waitress?
The daughter comes out.
Closet.
Yeah. When I heard closet, I was like, that's the thing that started them thinking about lobsters.
I think it's more of a Seinfeld comic-esque premise mm-hmm. where it was the punchline first.
Yeah.
And I think I'll have the veal as a proper alternative to lobster is, to me at least, would have been the seed of the joke.
And how do you stop a man from wanting to get lobster at a diner?
Les Mis.
The sketches, and watch it. Watch the sketch if you have it, but and then we'll describe it right now.
It features John Mulaney, features Keenan.
Yeah,
it's got Pete Thompson, right? Is that his name?
I didn't recognize anyone else.
The guy whose dad died in 9/11 who used to make jokes about it. I think his name is, I think it's Thompson. I might be wrong.
I don't know. Hunter S. Thompson.
Yeah, there you go.
I know. Anyway, so this sketch is these two people getting food at a diner.
Pete Davidson, Jesus, what's
wrong? Yeah, so they're ordering food, and John Mulaney orders lobster at a diner, which is clearly the wrong choice.
No. Let's go back. Pete Davidson orders lobster.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. John Mulaney's the waiter.
Okay.
So Mulaney comes out, asks them what they want. He makes a terrible joke about how the one guy's getting a salad, so it's the grilled cheese vagina style, which... Again, it's an okay joke, I guess.
It's not.
But so Pete Davidson orders the lobster, and Mulaney kind of steps back, asks him if he's sure. His friend even gives him a little shit about it. And then Mulaney just projects that they announces that somebody's ordered the lobster, and they bring out this giant tank that features Keenan in the tank
with
as
lobster.
A lobster.
Yes, but not full lobster, just has antennas on top of his head and is relatively there's a lot of lobster stuff going on, but it's very clear that he is Keenan with a beard dressed as a lobster with lobster claws, and it's fantastic. They do really good lobster pun versions of the two big Les Mis songs, Les Mis songs, the prisoner one. They also do the one do you hear the people sing?
Yeah,
do that. Do you hear the lobster
scream? Do you hear the lobster scream?
Which I also think could have been the genesis of this. Could have been, do you hear the lobster scream?
It could very well have been any of these amazing jokes that were peppered throughout.
Really, really good. Yeah,
Davidson breaks down early.
Very early.
The minute that the waitress comes over the minute Keenan starts singing, the camera pans and he's dead.
Yeah.
He's... Like, because I think it's because he knows what's coming. Mm-hmm. And he's dead. And then the waitress shows up behind him. The camera pans back and he's still dying.
Oh, yeah. I'm so surprised he was able to come back to it. Anyway, so watch this. It's funnier probably if you watch it.
Yes.
But so we were talking about this and I was remarking on like, he was probably also thinking about like David Foster Wallace's, who is an author, by the way, if you didn't know, David Foster Wallace's, he wrote an essay about lobsters called Consider the Lobster. And I was telling Pete about this because it sounds like you haven't read it before.
I have not.
It's like a, if I remember correctly, it's like a 20-page essay about lobsters. So that appeared in a like cooking or like a food magazine back in the 90s. This is when David Foster Wallace was still apparently writing for magazines on his off time. So he goes to the Maine Lobster Festival and he's supposed to write this entire article about like what happened at the Maine Lobster Festival. It's about a page of it is like, I was at the Maine Lobster Festival and it kind of sucked. And then it goes into his ruminations on like what it means to be a lobster, the pain that they go through when you boil a lobster. Is it ethical to have a festival where everyone's eating lobsters? His thoughts on humanity while he's there, which the only reason I'm bringing it up is because I think it's hilarious that he was able to get a gourmet like food magazine to run his article, which is essentially calling for people to never eat lobster again, or at least think about it. Which I like that whole thing is like, I think where the genesis of this kind of thought process comes from. I would not be surprised if Mulaney had read that.
Sure, sure.
So that's read it. It's better than it sounds, probably.
It sounds good.
It's good, but I mean, 20 pages, but so.
That sounds like a lot.
Yeah, it does, but it's actually, it reads well. He's always been a really great author, so.
Well, there you go. So yeah. Now you've got it. Go watch this hilarious sketch. Go read that fantastic article. Laugh, cry, feel for the lobster.
Yeah.
So anyway. Yeah. Back to business.
Yeah, Hayao Miyazaki.
We watched the third of our Miyazaki series of films. We watched Spirited Away. This was one I had actually heard of.
Good.
Actually, that's not true. I had heard of Princess Mononoke, but I had heard a lot more about this film before we watched it. Not so much of its content, but just this was one of the films people kept telling me about.
Yeah, I feel like people don't actually talk about the content of this film much. I can't remember the last time I've ever talked to someone about Spirited Away and they said anything about what happened in it besides all I ever get is people say that they like Spirited Away.
I mean, it's my favorite of the three we've watched.
It's good.
Let me just open with that.
Yeah.
If I have to rate them at this point, it's Spirited Away, Kiki's, and then Princess Mononoke, which shows that your order has been spot on so far.
I also want to just point out that this movie in America, this was came out in Japan before America, but Princess Mononoke came out in America 2 years before Spirited Away because it took so long for Princess Mononoke to come out. So you've experienced a similar thing to what people might have been seeing at the time, which is the dramatic leap in art and yeah. Like just the way that film looks is way better than Princess Mononoke.
Still, I talked to a few people recently that it turns out I have a lot of friends that have been into this stuff and they all really stand by Princess Mononoke as a top tier for them. And I just don't get it. And we'll kind of get more into this. I can't call myself a Miyazaki fan.
Mm-hmm.
I respect what he's doing. I don't think they're bad films. I think this one was the closest to a film that I can say that I liked. Mm-hmm. The other two were enjoyable in parts and interesting in parts, but as an experience, not the kind of thing where I would go back. Like, I don't think I'd watch them again. I don't think I would be pitching them to people.
Yeah, I can totally see that. And I honestly think like there's a bigger benefit to this when you're younger and like
yeah.
If you have kids, I'm imagining that you might
revisit
these films.
Actually, you're absolutely right. I think that is the case where I would bring these back because these are really good kids' films, I think.
Yeah, and like they do violence well, which is like interesting for like children. So yeah. Like I don't think
kids need to be sheltered from it in its entirety.
And I think that Miyazaki's very much on that exact same point.
Yeah.
So I think you make an excellent point. I don't think we've watched a film that was not intended for under 18 probably, and 18 would be a stretch.
Yeah.
Like Spirited Away is not going to resonate with someone that is at our age.
No, I mean,
and it shouldn't.
No, but at the same time, I just like we talked about in the last two movies, well, the last movie, the coming of age and all the symbolism is not gone unnoticed.
Yeah.
I think this movie was a little less on the nose than Kiki's was, but also had a better narrative to keep that morality play flowing.
Yeah, which I find interesting because if we think about Kiki and think about Spirited Away, they're very similar in their narrative. They're not like telling a story.
Fish out of water, it's girl, really, and how just she copes.
Moments.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is really just revisiting the same kind of things over and over again. Like you go through various experiences with her before going to the bathhouse and when she starts at the bathhouse, and then you revisit those scenes maybe once or twice. Like when she's going down the stairs in the beginning and then she has to cross that pipe.
Yeah.
And then she comes back to the stairs and she's fine. Like you see her growing in like very similar transitional pieces, which I think is like the way that everything is connected in this film is really that it's just showing the same kind of thing over and over to show progress.
And I think this is where I will say that I take a step back, and while it's not my cup of tea, I can't not respect a guy like Miyazaki and the way he crafts his films. Mm-hmm. They're structured beautifully.
Yeah.
They flow. There's symmetry. There's great use of symbolism. There's really great technique executed in things that just aren't meant for me.
Yeah.
But the technique is unarguable. Like it is very, very good craft.
I don't think you get to that stage if you don't make a movie like Kiki's. Like I really do think Kiki ends up being like his test for that kind of storytelling. Because like we watch Princess Mononoke, that's a traditional kind of story.
It's got a very different. Yeah.
Yeah. It has a narrative. And then you get into like the coming of age stuff, which if you haven't watched Totoro, but Totoro is more like these are some vignettes that are happening to these children. Same thing with Kiki. She's going through a series of like challenges and overcomes them. Spirited Away ends up being him having done that a few times and realizing how he can like make that work in a film.
Yeah.
And like
he weaved a story in this one, which was really nice.
Yeah, it's really cool. And a lot of that story isn't told, which is the interesting part. Like I think I like to go back to it, I think like from watching even the first 10 minutes, it's a lot more captivating than the other films.
Yes. Yeah, I was intrigued the whole time wondering what certain things, like, because again, it, obvious symbolism, but trying to decipher the meanings as opposed to the on-the-nose symbolism of Kiki's.
Yeah.
Like, No Face is baffling for most of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Until it takes the whole time. Yeah, until you get to the end. And even then, you and I discussed it afterwards, and I was still kind of like, okay, I get what you're saying, but like the movie did a good job of keeping it subtle and really like as a narrative drive as opposed to just on the nose. He stands for this. Like,
yeah,
I was kind of curious throughout, like, is there more to this character? Is he just symbolic? And he ended up being symbolic, but at the same time, it was done in a way that kept me intrigued throughout. And I wasn't disappointed by the resolution of his character.
Yeah. The themes I think that Miyazaki is going for is, told in a lot of different layers. So you do get some more on the nose ones. Like they're hard to miss if you like, he's inundating you with the same imagery over and over again. So you start getting the idea like food, really important, names, super important.
Right.
The things that are happening, like the West versus East culture, sure, is like super important.
Her parents becoming pigs because they ate the thing that wasn't theirs.
People changing when they eat is like a big deal. Like
multiple
characters change after they eat.
Not judging filth. And seeing the beauty behind the filth monster and realizing it was a spirit. Like,
I'm also going to say transitional spaces are super important. There's often her walking downstairs or through tunnels or like in an elevator shaft. Like there's a lot of moving between places rather than being in places. It's hitting you over the head with it in like a subtle way.
Yeah.
It's through the repetitiveness of that, that you kind of understand, like, these are the things that are important. Think about them a little bit more.
All right. And that's the craft being done better in this film than previous, where like you see that he's cracked the code.
Yeah, for sure. So I think before we like go any further, would you mind maybe like going through kind of what the film is about?
No,
I don't think we've actually talked about it.
I think that's kind of important 15 minutes into the
podcast.
Yeah. For those of you at home, hi Annie, hi Connor. Let's explain.
Hello.
Spirited Away.
We're going to get us some water.
We'll be right back.
Podcasters Delight Discount Edition. Hello, Chris. Today we're here to talk about Dune some more.
I've heard just like bits and pieces about Dune.
Yeah.
And it sounds like David Lynch kind of got hamstrung by some stuff, or maybe it was like his vision was too big for what was there.
Well, like Dune's a lot like the Bible. Mm-hmm. Like it's a lot of like a lot of time passes and a lot of like stuff happens, mm-hmm. but like it's never very detailed stuff.
Yeah,
it's best read like that, and it's very ambitious to make into a movie. If that makes sense,
would it serve better as like a longer form thing?
It is best served as a book, in my opinion.
Okay,
I'm sure that, because I don't know if you know, the guy who made the new Blade Runner is making Dune now.
Oh,
so
another movie or like
another movie? But he wants to make the first book in like two movies, which is really the way to do it.
Yeah,
because the shit is long as hell. Mm. It's good though.
Yeah.
It's a just there's like a lot of weird Catholic elements I think you'll like.
Excellent. Love the Catholicism.
Like all, because like it is a big space empire, but set up by like Earth.
Yeah.
So like they all have one religion. It was called the Orange Catholic Bible. It's weird, and there's like nuns run around and just stuff like that.
Awesome. I want to get to the Time Worm too. Time Worm seems dope.
Well, yeah. It's and eventually like people start fighting back against him because like he's like completely, he's omniscient. He's literally God, you know, he sees everything. And when he becomes like God himself and he sees the future and past all at the same time, he gets horrifically bored. Like he's just like, I've run out of there's nothing else left to know. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's neat.
Okay.
So
I'm down with that.
Yeah. So you ready to end this episode?
Let's end it.
You ready to play me off?
The head.
You ready? But you know, life as a superhero can be, ladies and gentlemen, stressful. I've flown all over the galaxy, but I always come back to a special place in my heart, a place called home. This one's for me, Mum. Seems like only yesterday I sailed from out of Cork. A wanderer from old Erin's Isle, I landed in New York. There was a soul to greet me there, a stranger on your shore. But Irish luck was with me here, and riches came galore. And now I'm going back again to dear old Erin's Isle. My friends will greet me on the pier, and greet me with a smile. Their faces sure I've almost forgot, I've been so long away. But me mother will introduce them all, and this to me she'll say.
Shake hands with your Uncle Mike, me boy, and here's your sister Kate. And there's the girl you used to swing down by the garden gate. Shake hands with all of the neighbors and kiss the colleens all. You're as welcome as the flowers in May in dear old Donegal. Meet Brannigan, Fannigan, Milligan, Gilligan, Duffy, McCuffy, Malachi, Malone, Rafferty, Lafferty, Donnelly, Connolly, Dooley, O'Hooley, Muldooney, Malone, Madigan, Carrigan, Lanahan, Flanahan, Fagan, O'Hagan, O'Hoolahan, Flynn, Shanahan, Manahan, Fogarty, Hogarty, Kelly, O'Kelly, McGinnis, McGinn, Brannigan, Fannigan, Milligan, Gilligan, Duffy, McCuffy, Malachi, Malone, Rafferty, Lafferty, Donnelly, Connolly, Dooley, O'Hooley, Muldooney, Malone, Madigan, Carrigan, Lanahan, Flanagan, Fagan, O'Hagan, O'Hoolahan, Flynn, Shanahan, Manahan, Fogarty, Hogarty, Kelly, O'Kelly, McGinnis, McGinn.
We've got water. And we're going to talk about the plot of Spirited Away.
Yeah, that's us.
So I'm going to do my best to recount the beginning. You're going to take over when I start to fumble.
I'll try. Connor, keep us honest.
Keep us honest.
With your replies, please.
I know Connor said we didn't talk about what the film's meant to us, so hopefully we're doing a better job this time around.
We'll talk.
Spirited Away is a tale of a young girl who, on a road trip with her parents, I think they're on their way to their new home. I don't remember where they're going.
They're moving, which is another transitional thing. Like, she's in the car transitioning to a new place.
Right.
We'll talk about symbolism, but transitions.
Right.
Very important.
So they're moving. They're on their way to their new home. Mm-hmm. And the father pulls up to this place that's
in his
like
dope Audi.
He is driving a dope ass Audi. And he comes upon this like this weird like tunnel farmhousey building that's got like a statue in front of the path to get through. So he gets out, the wife and daughter, the daughter very begrudgingly, they follow him into this little like village, I guess, on the water.
They kind of suck.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're investigating this area. The father smells food. And then a hilarious scene occurs where we literally watch the father follow his nose to this buffet. This unmanned, unattended buffet of fresh foods. And he and his wife just start pegging out.
And they're like, we can pay with it with credit card. It's fine. Let's just fucking gorge ourselves.
Their daughter is like, this is not cool.
Yeah. Again, a really overt symbolism of a cautionary tale of how the West does shit.
Yeah, greed.
That's really what it's talking about here.
Greed and gluttony are definitely negatives in this tale. And we see that in, what was her name?
Also, Western civilization is a negative thing. And who?
What was her name? At this
Chihiro?
Point in the movie? Was it?
Yeah, Chihiro.
Chihiro. So yeah, we see her, you know, telling us, no, this is wrong, this is wrong. She then at some point turns around and sees that her parents have become pig creatures. Does that happen, or does she run away first and then comes back?
She runs away first, comes back, doesn't believe it, is still looking for them after seeing the pig monster.
Okay, so she sees the pig monsters, runs.
Does not think that's them.
Right, right. And then comes to terms with the fact that those are her parents. And then bumps
after she's told.
Yeah, she bumps into Haku.
Haku, yes.
Haku, who seemingly knows what the fuck is going on as nightfall is coming and crazy ass spirits and creatures are coming in on like riverboats.
Yeah, with his cool bowl cut and and his cool like wind magic, like his water wind magic that he just like, yeah, I'll cause a distraction. Check out this magic right now. It's real cool.
And yeah, and again, he's telling her what's up. Like he seems like a friend. Someone she can trust, but also so in the know, you wonder his motives.
Yeah, and that's going to be there for most of the film.
Yep,
yeah.
There's very much a trust issue going on there.
And I think that this is actually when you start seeing when the animation starts taking place, like where it starts getting good. Like that first scene where he's starting to cast magic is when I start to notice like the movements are really interesting in this. There's like a lanky, almost thin, like body kind of thing going on that makes it look fast and fluid, which I really appreciate in this film. Just a note on the art here. This movie is contemporary with a lot of Disney films that were coming out at the time that were in 3D, but I'm forgetting their fucking names right now. Pete, do me a solid and look this up, what films came out. But note that all of this film is hand-drawn. There's nothing that's like done in computer.
Oh, 2001?
Art. Yeah, this is very contemporary to like things from Disney that have... Treasure Planet is a contemporary piece to this.
Ugh.
Same year. Like, that's where we're at
Shrek.
In the kind of, like, yeah, this is where we're...
Jimmy Neutron.
We're getting into, like, people are doing computer animation.
Final Fantasy, The Spirits Within.
Oh, God. And, yeah, so this is, like...
Osmosis Jones.
Yeah, this ends up being really, like... If you look at the list of Oscar nominees for Best Feature Film, this is the only one that's hand-drawn.
Yeah, it's definitely a better-looking film than what most of these look like based on the cover arts.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean... I see Shin Chan there, which is a great show.
Yeah, but it's not good art.
No,
come on.
Anyway,
let's be fair.
Back to the plot.
So so Haku, just to get into more like the inner workings of things, Haku is voiced by Jason Marsden, who has been a very prolific voice actor probably since this came out, if not longer than that.
Pizza Man. That's a good role.
Yeah, there you go. It's Pizza Man. He's done a lot of animated work, but he's also been a live action actor from way back in the day. And I'm trying to remember what he was. He was in Even Stevens.
He was in Static Shock.
He was a voice in Static Shock. He was in Ally McBeal. He did a lot of stuff in the like the 90s.
He's Clark Kent in Superman.
He has been Clark Kent. He was on Step by Step. That was one of his most prominent roles. Yeah, he was on Step by Step. Wow. This guy has been around. He was in Boy Meets World.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so you'd recognize him when you see him. He's this guy. We'll put a picture online. So this was Haku. Haku's been around forever. The voices were really good. I will say, like, I think that's another thing that's gotten better in all of his films. What's his face? Michael Chiklis, the Shield himself, plays her dad. Mm-hmm. Lauren Holly plays her mom. Mm-hmm. John Ratzenberger plays the assistant manager of the place. Like, there's really, really good actors in this movie that don't take over their roles.
Yeah, and I think the thing that I think what's really refreshing in this, like, yes, I cannot stress how much better the quality of this film is just from like production values. But the thing that I really like is the celebrities that they took, like you mentioned, do not overshadow their characters, and they feel like they're actually trying to voice act in this. And then there's also people who have never voice acted before.
Yes.
They're not just like casting every main character as someone who is known and trying to get people to go. This movie stood on its own and people were going to go for it, which
Agreed.
I thought was great.
The little girl who plays Chihiro, or Chihiro,
fucking Donnie Darko.
She was the little sister in Donnie Darko, as well as Samara in The Ring. That's right. In the American version of The Ring, she plays the monster girl.
How could I forget? This is contemporary with Lilo and Stitch.
Yes, it is contemporary with Lilo and Stitch. So yeah, anyway, we lost the plot again. So as these things come, Haku tells her to go hide and to go find this guy in this boiler room, ask him for a job, gives her all these instructions as to like how she's going to survive the night, basically.
The reason he'll be back. The reason for this is because she's in a place that humans are not allowed.
Yes.
And if she's caught while she's there, she can't exist there without working a job. That's
oh yeah, she
important.
Starts back to the futuring. She yes. starts becoming transparent. Yeah.
And Haku's very worried that if Yubaba gets, rightfully so, talks to her, will do something bad. You start to understand that Yubaba is the central negative force in this film that is like constantly trying to pull one over on people.
Yeah, Yubaba's clearly our villain the first time she's mentioned, and by the time we meet her, we understand why.
Which is why Haku says, go to the boiler man and try to get a job from him. Get a job from the guy who's not going to pull one over on
you. Which is amazing because he is fucking terrifying, and the fact that he's the positive force in this little tug of war is bananas. Just without going too deep into it, I think in hindsight, there's a relationship I would have liked to have seen more about.
Boiler Man?
And Yubaba. And or what's her name?
Yubaba?
Yubaba. I'd like to know why he's the good option as opposed to her being the bad option. What's their dynamic?
Yeah.
What's he doing down there by himself? How'd he end up there? What is their relationship? I'd like to see that spinoff.
Mm-hmm.
I'd watch that
There's
movie.
A lot. And I'm going to just say Miyazaki does a lot after this. He does a lot with like people who are forced to work for someone else based on like a contract that they've signed. You're starting to see that in this film, like the concept of you gave away some part of yourself for a job. That's very much like if you watch Howl's Moving Castle, there's a lot of that.
I plan on watching more of his work because even though I wouldn't call myself a fan, I'm enjoying this experience. I'm enjoying watching his movies. I think I'm going to watch them all at some point. She goes, tries to get a job with the Boiler Man. It doesn't go well. He tells Lynn, one of his girl workers, to take her to Yubaba,
mm-hmm.
which is where things start going wrong.
Yes.
Because Yubaba basically tells her to fuck off at first and then tells her, okay, I'll give you a job, but I'm taking your name, which is symbolic.
Mm-hmm.
Takes her name, gives her a new name, which translates to...
Thousand. It's part of her name.
Okay.
But it ends up being stripping her of all of her meaning and just making her a number.
Okay, so she becomes a number instead of a person, which is symbolic.
Which we didn't get from the Japanese as a post-understanding.
Yeah. And she's given a job to work in the bathhouse with Lynn, and live with Lynn and all of the workers and become a part of this happy family.
And Lynn, fantastic character.
Oh my God.
Really like Lynn.
Lynn is so just like, fuck, I gotta take care of this dumb kid. Like,
but
there's so
also,
many great moments where she's like, come on, dummy.
But also like, fucking, yeah, I'm so glad that worked out for you.
Yeah.
Now come along with me, you idiot.
Yeah, she's like really, she's Aubrey Plaza.
Mm-hmm.
Like if they did a live action version of this movie, Aubrey Plaza would play Lynn because she would play that like sweet, but with that really hardened exterior. But there's a great person in there that just wants to see people succeed and benefit.
Somehow her and the Boiler Man are like best friends.
Thick as thieves. Yeah. Like, I'm telling you, she's April from Parks and Rec.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if the writers of Parks and Rec based April on Lynn from this movie.
I wouldn't be surprised if they based April on the character she played in Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
That was later.
Was it?
Yeah. She was already April at that point.
I watched Parks and Rec so far after that because it was so bad when it started.
Oh, well, we'll do in a whole thing on that.
I've watched it.
Oh, okay. I love Parks and Rec.
I just don't like that first season.
It is rough. Yeah. Once they get rid of What's-His-Face, it gets better.
Yeah, I watched. Anyway, this is a different story.
Yeah. So. Oh fuck! I lost my place.
Where she's got?
She's
a job,
working.
She's with Lynn.
She's working. I'm gonna throw in some photos here.
We could do that too.
And I was gonna do working for a living. We still might throw it in. So she's now working and she's
working at the bathhouse.
At the bathhouse, yeah. We see her kind of learning the ropes and getting her one outfit she gets to wear for the rest of her life. Basically, stripping herself of her. Her individuality.
Look, they don't have the most budget where they can change the costumes every day.
Right. No, but I appreciate the symbolism there. Yeah. Like, her individuality is stripped away.
That's a very Western thing to do, to put you in a uniform when you're working.
Yep. No, I definitely agree.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we'll skip through a lot of this. Her relationship with Haku is weird because he's kind of mysterious. We learn that he works for Yababa, like he's her right hand,
but is kind of not working for her.
Right. Yeah. He's doing his own thing a little bit. He's also trying to help Chihiro, even though she's on the fence, because Lynn is like, he's a bad dude, don't trust him. Mm-hmm. So that whole dynamic is going down. Fast forward through a lot. I mean, I want to let you kind of take over here because Yeah.
Let's do it. So the first thing that happens with Lynn, she's scrubbing the bathtub with Chihiro, who is Chen now or something. And they're scrubbing that bathroom. Chen, yeah. And that's when you get your first interesting like new character, which is this giant muddy god comes in.
Wait. We skipped something so important that I'm going to back you
is
up
it
here.
No Face on a Bridge?
No, we skipped Radish Man.
Well, yeah, I was going to bring him up later. But
he happens before. He's the first interaction. I'm sorry. The first interaction she has at the bathhouse is with this awesome white radish man.
Who is so good. So they're taking an elevator up to Yubaba. That's where you've missed the entire like Metal Gear plot that's happening.
I did. I'm sorry. Jump in. Yeah.
No, it's cool. So this is for Connor. This is where Chihiro is trying. So she can't be seen because if they see a human, they're... something bad will happen. Like, no, you're not allowed to be human there. So everybody's looking for human. So Lynn is basically hiding Chihiro for like a newt, like a boiled. Like
I forgot about all that. Yeah.
For a newt and bringing her up this elevator and has to cross the elevator. And you get like this awesome scene where Lynn puts her in an elevator and a giant radish man comes in and basically protects her by just like going up and being in front of her. But this giant radish man is the slowest, biggest, fucking awesome character design I've seen. He's my standout character design.
He was memorable enough where I had to stop myself while rushing through the beginning of the plot and said, wait, we forgot to talk about him.
Yeah,
that's how awesome
he's the
he
radish spirit, and he's dope.
Yeah.
He's clearly rich because he can afford baths at this bathhouse.
Yes. I forgot he was basically her protector on her way to Yobaba.
And that's all you get of him. And
until
that's
the end.
Great.
We see him again briefly in the end.
Yes.
Yeah.
Perfect. It's over. And then they get to Yubaba and it's great.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Lynn's working. Giant stink monster comes in. Stink god. And Yubaba's like, you're going to do this because I think you're going to wash out right here. And that's when
pun
I
intended.
Can fucking take your, like, yeah, pun intended. But like, if you fuck up, no more job, you're done.
Right.
Like, this is life or death for her. And so this is where you start getting the theme of like of consumption and like appearances not being what they are. So they give this giant stink monster a wash, which there's some stuff that happened.
But it's hilarious.
Yeah, No Face gave her some like bath tokens a little while ago because he's trying to like figure out his life.
We haven't really mentioned No Face yet.
And I think that that's okay.
Yeah. There's this weird faceless spirit thing that's kind of like showing up random times and like seemingly trying to help Sin or Chihiro.
Trying to do something. He's trying to figure out his place in life. So she watches this giant stink god, and you get this great scene of them pulling trash out of a stink god, everybody doing that.
Yeah, she recognizes a handle from a bike coming out of his side.
And Yubaba being like, holy shit, this girl's the best, because after they like pull out all this trash, he turns into a water spirit that's fucking rich, which that's the only thing Yubaba cares about is how rich they are.
Yeah, it's like, we just got paid.
And you're starting to understand a little bit more about Yubaba. He's come into the place. He's a stink god. They don't want him to be there, but she never turns away a customer. That's like part of her like self-imposed rules.
It's money to be made.
If someone asks you for a job, she gives them a job. If someone comes there, she's going to do what they're going to get service. So she gets gold out of this.
Yep, lots of gold.
Lots of gold. And that's when you get like a plot device. Basically, like you get the whatever Falcon. You get her Deus Ex piece, the like little green thing that comes out. So fast forward a little bit, we got Chihiro. So she has since then been working with Lin. She's getting closer and closer to that. She sees Haku get basically destroyed by a bunch of paper doves, which are
attacking a spirit.
Yeah, a giant water dragon who's flying through the sky, which is real cool.
Yes.
And then she learns that that's Haku, who is basically dying now, and he's dying because he stole something from another witch. And you start to learn that he's trying to learn magic, and we don't really know why, but he's just attempting to do that. Yubaba is going to leave him for dead. This is where Chihiro is like, no, we're not going to do that. I'm going to save you. And basically, through her own like giving selflessness, is able to like cure him of that disease that he has, because after stealing the magic, he has like a curse on him.
Right.
Cut to now, she has to go and travel and go to another witch.
Right. Who we met.
Oh.
She came, and that's how we meet her, is she shows up when she's trying to save Haku.
Yes.
And she looks exactly like Yubaba, because she's her twin sister.
Yes.
Who is a witch.
Yes.
And lives somewhere else.
Yep.
And she transforms Yobaba's baby, who we didn't mention, into a hamster or something?
Yeah, like a mouse hamster.
Yeah, some kind of rodent.
It's real fucking good. Yeah. And the Yubaba bird into like a tiny bird.
Yeah. So the two of them are now palling about with Chihiro on their way to go to the witch and try to save Haku.
Yeah, and there's that giant baby, so good.
That giant baby is, honestly, that's a runner-up against Radish Man as far as favorite characters in this, especially in the end.
Yeah, when he's like, nah, I like
the
hamster.
Yeah, so real quick, fast-forwarding a little bit of the plot, like when they finally get to the resolution and like the mother realizes that her baby is a hamster, she like freaks out and is like, what did you do, blah, blah, blah. And he turns right back into a baby and is like, nah, it's cool, I was enjoying this. It's so fucking funny.
It really is. It's really good. We are skipping a lot of things.
We are.
Well, so suffice it to say, in the middle of this, No Face is showing up.
Okay. So No Face is at the bathhouse, and he eats this little froggy dude after luring him with gold. He basically lures him with gold until he gets close enough to eat him. He absorbs him, grows, has the little froggy legs and arms now as a part of his body.
And now he can talk.
And now he can talk basically in froggy voice. He's no longer just moaning around. And he continues to lure people and eat them until he finally stops eating and is now just using all of the gold he has to get whatever the fuck he wants. He becomes the high roller of the bathhouse. Mm-hmm. But now he realizes he's not happy with all he's got. He wants Chihiro.
Yes.
He wants her to come to him, and he wants to give her all the gold and have her for his own.
Right. And him rampaging through the entire bathhouse is how Chihiro is able to Metal Gear through the entire bathhouse down to Kamaji the Boiler Man and talk about getting a train ticket and all of that.
Correct. So he plays a great distraction.
Exactly. And this is when we start getting our Jesus moment where she's like, I'm going to go fix this.
And I think Boiler Man is the first one to mention that love is what's going to make her succeed.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That becomes our one super on the nose theme in this movie.
Yeah, to be fair, that's a lot of on the nose themes in many movies.
Yeah. So love is going to fix everything. Her love for Haku is going to help. I was happy that her love for Haku was not some kind of romantic bullshit, but it was just a genuine love from one human being to another for being there for them.
Human being who is also a river.
Well, okay, so we haven't gotten there yet.
But I'm just, for our two listeners, you already know.
Okay, so I'm just going to fast forward some more then. Mm-hmm. So she goes, not even fast forward, but just kind of blaze through here. So she gets the notice, like they find her and tell her like, yo, you got to stop this rampaging no face. Like he wants you, nothing's going to stop him, you know, roll in. So she shows up and he's like, you know, here, I got this for you. And he tries to lure her and he gets all angry and she's just like, no. And she puts her foot down and says no to him. And that's enough to stop him. And yeah. He basically becomes subdued. She starts luring him away from the bathhouse, which is clearly what's causing him to become this creature of greed. Mm-hmm. And the further away he gets from the bathhouse with Chihiro, the less terrifying and awful he is.
Ish. She does use her Deus Ex Machina green ball, the other half.
Oh, yeah. She feeds him the little dragon ball thingy,
which is the cure-all.
Yes, it's the panacea.
And so he starts purging.
Yes.
Everything that he can.
Oh, that's right. There's
way.
That whole vomiting sequence. Yes. I forgot about that. Yeah,
so,
yeah,
so this
yeah.
is the expulsion of everything that he has consumed. This is like getting rid of the greed. This is you tried to figure out your place in life by consuming others and just taking their personalities.
Let me translate for Connor. He just read Marx for the first time, and he's becoming the man he was always meant to be.
Okay. Yeah, I think
come on.
After watching this movie, I immediately told Pete that this is basically Hideo. Yes, Miyazaki and Connor would probably have very similar political spectrums.
Absolutely. So that all goes down. They get to what the fuck is the sister's name? Zaniba?
Yeah, Zaniba.
Zaniba's place, and Zaniba turns out to be real chill.
Yeah, she's just like a normal Japanese witch instead of one that's been corrupted by the West.
Yeah, and she's just like, you know, I did this to Haku because he worked for my sister and was stealing from me, and that shit ain't going to fly. And she's like, well, he was doing it to try to save himself, and she explains it. And it essentially turns into Zaniba realizes she needs to help, and she feels bad for them. And they go back to face Yobaba and help Haku and... You want to go into the deal a little bit? Because I don't remember the details of the deal exactly. It was something about Yobaba was going to give her name back if she could pass one more test, right?
Might not remember this as well, to be totally
you
honest.
Don't either? Okay. No. Basically, like, while Chihiro is negotiating with the sister, Yobaba is negotiating with Haku about how when she comes back, she has to let her go.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of leverage did Haku have? What was he holding over Yobaba?
I don't know.
He had some kind of leverage on her. I think it was just like him like giving himself to her or some shit. I don't remember. Anyway, she comes back. She passes the test like right away because it was like spot your parents in the pig farm. And she's like, yep. They're not here. And she succeeds. And then she saves Haku. Mm-hmm. And they go flying away. Together as his spirit thing, his spirit dragon,
mm-hmm.
to which she starts having flashbacks from when she was a child. Early in the movie, we hear Haku mention to her when they first meet that he's known her a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a weird, mysterious line that never comes up again until this ending, where she starts having flashbacks of herself almost drowning in a river,
mm-hmm.
And being saved seemingly by the river. And she realizes that the river is Haku,
mm-hmm.
and that he lost his riverness when they put the rocks in the way and they basically like stopped the river from flowing. And then he was susceptible to Yobaba, who took away his name, made him one of her workers.
Yeah. because he lost his name when he stopped being a river.
Right. So Chihiro gives him basically his being back with that memory, and he returns to tell Yobaba to fuck off.
And he gives her her name back.
And he, yeah, that's right. And then he gives her her name back, and there's a nice, beautiful exchange there. Yeah, and that's the movie. I think she goes back, and her parents are there like nothing ever happened, and they live happily ever after.
And we've all grown.
We've all grown. This, as you can tell probably just from having listened to the last two episodes and now listening to this one, there's a lot more going on in this movie.
Yes. I think there was a lot going on in Princess Mononoke. I don't want to say that there wasn't in terms of plot. But this one has done so much with so little, I think is very impressive. Like, Princess Mononoke has a strict plot that is like spelled out for you, whereas this one like really doesn't. It's a lot of visual and conversations, and you don't have someone saying you have to go do this thing. She's developing that for herself. She's not on a quest or anything like that. She's really just trying to survive. And it does a lot with so much less and does it so much better that it ends up being really, really much more interesting.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is a much more like let the viewer interpret things for themselves, take the viewer on an adventure that's not just laid out so perfectly for them. Like, it really, again, I haven't seen the rest of his work, but if all he did was these three movies, this is him top of his craft.
Yeah. And so, which brings us back to the crux of like, why did we do these three movies?
Yeah.
And it's to show, I think, the widest range, not the widest range, but a scope of Miyazaki's kind of work. This is very much like coming of tale kind of Miyazaki. Like, I think you get aspects of Princess Mononoke and Kiki in Spirited Away, but you can see his development from them. I'm hoping like from having watched all three of those, you're getting a bigger picture of how he operates.
Yeah. And the next one you've not seen, right?
No, I have not. It's going to be The Wind Also Rises.
And is this a newer film?
Yes. I believe it's within like the last 4 years.
This is exciting. So we're going to see if he truly has grown since then.
Yeah. And, so back to like, let's do talk a little bit about themes now.
Yeah.
Unless you want to take like a short break.
We can take a short break.
Okay.
We'll be right back.
It has effective on no matter what surface.
Yeah, it's pretty nice.
It's pretty good. This is a table. This is a picnic table.
Like a giant worm soup.
And we're back. I just watched the trailer for Ponyo, and I think it's adorable, and I'm going to watch it one day.
Yeah, I just kind of wanted to show Pete how far animation has come, because we were looking at the what goes on in The Wind Rises.
Yeah, that too. We're looking into our next film. But anyway, back to this film. Justin, you wanted to talk about some stuff.
Yeah, let's talk about some themes while we're at it. Let's talk about some things that this film does well from like a visual and storytelling perspective. So I think that we've been dancing around these subjects, but things that this film is talking about, in my perspective, really is like, and Miyazaki focuses on this a lot, is like, what does Japan's role live like? What does that look like when the West is here? What is our identity? And you get a lot of that from like the parents, the bathhouse, the like Yubaba herself. Like, all of these characters are taken Japanese things and then gotten really greedy, which ends up being like that is what the West has brought, is like greed. Is my reading here. So you have like her parents who, like with the credit card and everything and the Audi and the trespassing and thinking that everything is, like a fake, like there's a really cool line.
It's
where
a theme park is what he thinks.
He thinks it's a theme park, not recognizing Japanese heritage, which is kind of wild. And yeah, so you get a lot of that that ends up just being like a very like one-sided theme. I think that Miyazaki's firmly in the stance of know your own identity. Don't let the West override everything that you already know. It might be okay, but at the end of the day, like, don't get too greedy. Stand by yourself. Like, Zaniba is a better person than Yubaba.
Right.
And that's...
But there are two sides of a coin.
Yes. But it's told through, like... Yeah. And you end up realizing that Zaniba is a better person because I think that the, like, West versus East thing really coincides with the idea of identity in this film, which ends up being, like, the main plot point, the main theme the entire time is, like, understanding who you are. It's real obvious from the way that you have people losing their names. You have characters who don't even have names, who are defined by the fact that they don't have a name, which is No Face. Like, it's just his description of himself.
Right.
But also defined by the way that when you are gluttonous, or when you consume something, you're changed into something else. So, like, the parents, they eat a ton of stuff, become pigs, and that's, you know, symbolic of Western culture destroying the East. But it's also, you know, the river spirit who has been polluted to the point where you now think he's a stink god, which is completely opposite of what he is. And when you are able to remove that pollution, you see him for what he really is. Or Haku, who has lost his identity from himself being destroyed by Western civilization, essentially.
Yep.
Or, you know, you get Chihiro signing her name away for a job so that she can survive. And, like, most importantly, though, ends up being No Face. And No Face being, like, a really interesting character that's not spelled out and kind of difficult to understand, I find, when you're watching that film.
Yeah. I was a little confused while watching, but, like, in hindsight, he makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, it really does take up until he actually meets Zaniba to understand what's going on. So just for everybody who's watching.
He's an underdeveloped
being. I think he's full... Oh, yeah. I think that he actually, like, his whole arc gets fully developed by the end of this.
Yes.
And so...
Although, no, I would argue no, because I feel like that's where Zaniba comes in.
Yeah, no, I'll get there. So... We have No Face, who is really just a spirit who doesn't have, like, an identity, and his whole purpose seems to be to figure out his identity. Mm-hmm. And so the way he's going about that is in a flawed way, like the rest of the characters. He's consuming things to take on other people's aspects.
He's doing what he sees, because even if you think about when he first meets Chihiro, he's a different character.
Mm-hmm.
He's a little more compassionate. He's giving. He's helpful because he's emulating her.
Yeah, but
then he sees more of what's happening in the bathhouse and becomes that consumer because he's watching it happen.
And I like that he's giving in a pretend way. One way that, like, I think that we skipped over this, but at the end there, he gives a lot of gold to everybody, but that gold ends up being trash.
It was bullshit. Yeah.
And so, like, everybody's worse off for that encounter except for No Face, which is really great. I think, again, really picking at that, like, Western philosophy, like, don't be too greedy, like, don't look a gift horse in the mouth for a second.
Right.
But, yeah, like, so No Face is trying to figure out who he is or, like, what he is, and he's doing that, you're right, through the way, like, everyone else
is
consuming.
The lens of what's around him, yeah.
And so he is literally consuming people. Like, he takes on a voice only when he consumes the frog guy, and he starts to develop their characteristics. He eats another couple people, gains hair, and it's pretty obvious that as he consumes people, he starts to grow characteristics and talk. But the way that Chihiro interacts with him to, like, essentially purge that, getting rid of that consumption and allowing him to, like, become himself again, really showcasing that, like, just emulating and consuming things is not the way to develop your personality. It has a lot to do with, like, the kind of personality crisis that a lot of people experienced as the world ended up being more, like, IKEA friendly, where you're saying, like, everybody's going to have these kinds of things. This is basically Fight Club is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Is, like,
the cookie cutter world was forming.
Yeah. And so they go off on their journey. And I think where we get the full arc of No Face is you see the flawed journey to understand himself. And then you get to Zaniba. And Zaniba's just like, fucking just try spinning this thread. And he's like, oh, I've never. Oh, cool. let me try that. He's like learning something. Yeah, that,
I made a thing and it didn't hurt anybody and it's mine. I did it myself.
Yeah. And so it ends up being like learn a craft skill.
Right. But I think that's for me, like I think the only reason I argued with you is because I think that really is more of a beginning of his tale than an end.
Yeah.
Because this is him finally getting guidance instead of just blindly emulating what he sees. He gets help in finding who he is.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if there's a natural arc, maybe one day No Face will have his own face because, you know, he finally finds himself in his craft or his skill or whatever.
True.
It's very nice. And again, you know, you were right in the beginning where I kept trying to say it's less on the, it is less on the nose. It's still very much on the nose.
Yes.
Just, it's the kind of thing where it doesn't pull you out of the story. And it actually makes you want to talk about the themes at the end of the movie, as opposed to, I'm sorry, but Princess Mononoke, okay, I wasn't that interested in talking about the movie when we were done, because I'm like, I don't think we're going to really crack away at much. There wasn't much nuance that we're going to chip away at in discussion. In this movie, it's like, oh, we can actually discuss these themes and what they mean and how they're relevant. And
yeah, and I think Miyazaki tried to put some nuance in Mononoke, but largely you understand like deforestation is bad.
For children though.
Yeah, totally.
Terrific. Like that is nuanced enough for a child to learn something and be more curious about something that they might not have known about before.
I like that the themes in this film all have to do with either the actions of a character or the placement of a character.
Yes.
And the only other thing that I would like to, I think, explore is like, along with that consumption, ends up being, and I've talked about it before, was, how often, Chihiro is transitioning somewhere.
Yes.
It's a little on the head, but it is meant to show how she is moving forward and how she is progressing. And also to like really put into place that, as a coming of age tale, she's in transition. She's in that space between knowing her role in society. Like, she doesn't know it right now. And by the end of the film has figured it out. She's literally on the cusp of, I'm no longer a child, but I'm not an adult. And you're treating me this way, but I really don't know what I need. I'm learning this job, but I'm at the learning phase there.
She's an early stage Britney Spears song.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. She's yes. And I think that the transition, like, I like the idea that showing someone in a lot of different like staircases and elevators and running on pipes and stuff is a really cool way to show how people transition.
It is.
That first shot walking through that tunnel is like super, yeah, we're moving between spaces here.
I like the wind pushing her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, so at the end of the day, like, they're not wildly new themes.
No.
And
they're just well done.
They're very well done.
And I think you're right. The overwhelming and I think most important theme is identity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I think of all these movies, this is the best one so far. It's really just a really good, fun story with really good characters all around. I give this one an A+. This was top notch for me.
I'm really glad that he chose to make this one after the others. He wrote this at the same time that he wrote Kiki's Delivery Service and Ponyo. Totoro. But I'm glad he spent the time working with his studio to develop their art style, because I think the thing that really makes this a standout film ends up being like, it is well done, but it could be well done with bad animation and it would just be okay.
Yeah.
The animation in this film is still by far some of the best animation.
Stellar.
Seen. Yeah. And like the detail that's put into the backgrounds and into the characters, it just kills everything else that people have been doing.
Agreed.
Yeah.
So, this was top notch. Two more we're gonna do?
Yeah, so we're gonna watch The Wind Rises.
Yep, that's next.
Both of us haven't seen this.
Yeah, this is a fresh take from both of us.
And then we're gonna do a fifth movie with one of our listeners.
We could talk about it now.
So Connor, we're gonna have you on this podcast. You're gonna bring a movie about a pig.
About a pig.
Porco Rocco.
That's the one. So we're going to watch that after we watch The Wind Rises. And after that, we're going to start a new series. We haven't decided what that is yet, probably going to go music, I think.
Yeah.
But we'll figure that all out, and we'll get back to you guys.
Later date, Blade Runner.
Oh, yeah, for sure. We're going to do the Blade Runner films. We got a lot of ideas for what we're going to do here, so we hope you're enjoying them.
Yeah, thanks for listening, Connor.
Yeah, and Annie. Thanks, guys. We'll see you next week.